something that I think is enormously significant, probably the most significant thing, is the past 10 years, since roughly, since we've had the internet, that has made such a global change in the way artists can be, the way artists have an ability now to see income from their work, the way that artists do not need publishers other than themselves as publisher. They do not need record companies, although it is very nice to have a record company behind you, Philip of Inova. It is very wonderful to have those things, but it is not any longer a necessity. If you have the business tools and a little bit of acumen, or a fair amount of acumen, to and wherewithal to get it together, you can very relatively easily, the only thing that's not easy are the long hours, I would say, any artist can put their work out there and find their niche, find their fan base, find their audiences.
Welcome to Measure for Measure, new music, new thoughts. A series of conversations with movers and shakers and a few cage rattlers on the front lines of the new music universe. I'm Philip Blackburn from the American Composers Forum. We'll be talking about where old school ideas meet the new, searching backstage for handy hints that might give composers a leg up, what it means these days to compose a career, and trying to figure out the question of life, music, and everything. Please visit us online at composersforum.org/measureformeasure and share your thoughts about today's show at composersforum.gather.com. Measure for Measure is supported by the National Endowment for the Arts, that believes that a great nation deserves great art. I guess my first question to you, Alex Shapiro, is, if you were the keynote speaker for the conference of your dreams, what would your topic be?
It would be joy. It would be don't be disconnected ever, no matter what you're doing, whether it's music or anything else, from that inner impetus that gives you the drive to do it in the first place. Because it's not about someone telling you you're good at it, and it's not about all the things you may or may not have studied in school or conservatory. It's really the reason to do it is immense joy, we hope, immense joy. Because life is so short. And if we have the ability to share something with other people, if music is about communicating, what's a more wonderful thing to communicate than that? So I think that's what I would talk about.
Let's talk about that. All right, we're in this conference now. We are surrounded by what I can see is no obstacle to joy. You live in Malibu. The sun is shining on this day, as I'm sure it is every day. The parrots are flying overhead. We've got relaxed kitties who've That's experienced right. all the joy that they plan to.
After having slept for 20 hours, yeah.
I have no reason to believe anything has changed.
That's right.
Or will change. And yet, there may be listeners out there who don't have their full quota of joy and are indeed finding obstacles to fulfilling that. They may be composers, they may be artists, they may be curious onlookers, they may be psychiatrists out there figuring out what's wrong with those guys. So what are some of the things that we've internalized that have brought us to this position? I know Sturm und Drang has been around a lot, mm-hmm. but we're not in those Teutonic days of Haydn anymore. What gives?
We're not in those days, however. If we have to think for a moment outside of our little musical tide pool, and I'm going to be very United States-centric for a moment, and somewhat obliquely, or not so political, to say that we are now in a culture, more than ever, that is focusing on fear and anger and negative emotions, largely fear. Fear is a great way to control a populace. Fear is a great way to keep in office because people are too scared to, you know, have any change happen in midstream when things aren't going too well. I could go on, and I won't because that's not the nature of this program. But I think in our culture in the United States, we are sadly just pummeled constantly with negative emotions, negative information, fearful things. And if you do happen to turn on the TV or the radio at any given time of the day, or go to the movies, many of them, or whatever your media choice is, other than something abstract like music, or certainly music without lyrics, you're pretty much bombarded with this, and it seeps into our collective consciousness. It is unavoidable. I'm one of those people who chooses much less frequently to tune into those things, and yet I'm still really, really aware of it, and sadly so. And it gets reflected in my work. Sometimes some of my pieces are definitely political, as much as something intangible can be. But I think in our society right now, we are suffering greatly from an absence, back to the joy thing, an absence of the sense that you can create your own world around you separate from what you're being told is the reality. Because right now, a lot of the reality is just awful, it's dreadful. And some of that we have responsibility for at the voting booth. Some of that we have responsibility for in terms of what do we tell our friends and our family, and how do we shape our days each day and each week and each month that we are relating to people. And then as artists, how can we reach out? And that doesn't mean, I don't mean with pretty music. Sturm und Drang is alive and well in my household. There's a lot of angst in some of my music. And that's a really healthy way, I think, for it to come out. But to be addressing it and to be fighting against it in a sense and rallying against it, saying there can be joy and beauty no matter what kind of emotion you're expressing, that's very different from what outside influences in our world would like us to be experiencing it. And you can't necessarily change the world with this, but you can affect your reality and your corner of it for a few moments, at least a day, maybe. Maybe that's all it is, you know.
Tell me the name of your publishing company.
Activist Music.
Why is that?
Well, I have been pretty activist in a lot of my life. I have always taken a very hands-on approach to, just because one is an artist doesn't mean one doesn't have opinions that are worth hearing, not just in art and music, but in things like civil liberties. I was very involved for many years in the 90s with the American Civil Liberties Union. I was vice president of their largest affiliate here in Southern California, ACLU of Southern California, for a couple of years, and I was on their board for 6 years or 8 years or whatever, 6 years, I think. And at the time, I was doing some very uncomposerly kinds of things while I was making my living as a composer. I was also chair of the State and National Legislative Action Committee. You know, I was out there also with issues like reproductive freedom and other things, and First Amendment issues that affect all artists, and trying to help other people express themselves. And I think now with art, I'm able to do that as well, and certainly I get very plugged into organizations here in Los Angeles, and certainly the American Composers Forum nationally, as well as the local chapter here in Los Angeles, trying to show, perhaps by example, that all of us have something worthwhile to say, and to encourage people to get out there, and whatever it is for them that they want to say, that they should make their voice heard. And artists have a great ability to do this. They really do.
Especially those artists who have been fulfilled on some level, mm-hmm. like self-actualized, I mean, I guess you could call it. But there's also a lot of conformity, because the pressures of the industry, shall we say, mm-hmm. including the educational system, these are the rules. Never mind that they were invented from scratch in the Paris Conservatoire in 1804 as just a little experiment. And this is a series of skills you must have in order to make your living in business and sell this commodity known as music to the marketplace. It's kind of scary to break out of that and think, well, it looks like you have lived a life that takes it as given that you can have an influence in organizing society. You can have a sense of change, you can operate on some level larger than yourself. And that your music can also do that in the way that you've built the infrastructure and contributed to a musical world around you as well. I'm sure you find it comes back in many unpredictable ways. All of this is in kind of opposition to a lot of the forces at play that suggest, I've got my degree, I'm entitled to a commission, I should have got that one, but I'll get the next one, and all I have to do is go through the motions of providing more music without really questioning whether the world needs it, mm-hmm. whether I need it, whether it's truly me rather than someone else.
That's right.
And we've got this kind of glut of stuff out there that you know, more and more people are making it thanks to technology and other things, and graduating composers at a higher rate than the market can consume. Mm-hmm. You know, how is it that we're able to work this sort of industry without any of the normal rules of supply and demand and still expect to make a living? What's going on here?
What is going on here? It's very interesting to see that never, and back again to United States culture, I would say that certainly in terms of art music, for lack of a better term, or concert music, we're in a culture that doesn't really put that on the top rung of necessities, doesn't value it terribly much, unfortunately. And yet there are so many composers. There are thousands of composers. What a wonderful thing this is. It's marvelous that there are so many composers. So there must be something going on that's very separate, the desire to compose and to communicate and reach out to other people is it transcends whatever our society is on one level. On another, something that I think is enormously significant, probably the most significant thing, is the past 10 years, since we've had the internet, that has made such a global change in the way artists can be, the way artists have an ability now to see income from their work, the way that artists do not need publishers other than themselves as publisher. They do not need record companies, although it is very nice to have a record company behind you, Philip of Innova. It is very wonderful to have those things, but it is not any longer a necessity. If you have the business tools and a little bit of acumen, or a fair amount of acumen, to and wherewithal to get it together, you can very relatively easily, the only thing that's not easy are the long hours, I would say, any artist can put their work out there and find their niche, find their fan base, find their audiences. And it comes back to something you were saying about, well, gee, you know, you've got your academic degree and you just sit back and wait for all those commissions to roll in. No, 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 no. I have always said, and I've said this long before the internet, and I really believe it now, composers have to earn the interest of their audience. We have to earn it. How dare we be so arrogant as to think, well, just because I think I'm great and I think I'm wonderful, well, everybody else should as well. It doesn't. That's a 19th century romantic with a capital R construct. It does not work in 2006. It is it's a meaningless concept at this point. It's up to us to, first of all, believe in our own worth without question. An artist has to feel that they have something worthy to share with others. If you don't have that general sense of self-esteem, it's very hard for you to sell your product, to use a crass analogy, but that is in a sense what you're doing. You're trying to convince other people to listen to it, to buy the concert tickets, to buy your CDs, to buy your scores if they're performers, and buy the t-shirts and mugs on, you know, and whatever it's they're going to buy. And if you don't believe that it has worth, first of all, then it's very hard to get it out there. But secondarily, you have to find outlets that are not going to come knocking on your door. You have to knock on its door. And we've never had a better tool, ever. And we'll have better ones in the future. But we've never had as good one now as we do with the internet. And for me, I look at this in my own work, and it is astonishing. It blows my mind every single week when I look at the people I'm dealing with from all over the world, people, many of whom not only have I never met, but I will never meet, I'm sure, nor will I ever hear their voice even on the telephone, and yet they play and record my things, or I'm interacting with them constantly on other things, and it's really, it's magnificent. And every artist, I believe, who has access to, you know, a high-speed internet line, at least, and a computer, can have this for themselves. You can do all these things yourself. I did my own website, I do my own publishing. You know, I could presumably at this point in my career knock on a publisher's door and say, "Hi, you want something?" And I'm not doing that. I don't think that behooves composers. Why give all your money away to someone else when you can, when it's not that much money, frankly, to begin with in our business, and you can keep it yourself and build upon that, and get your work out there without those gatekeepers.
Do you think there are personality types that really can't sell themselves very well?
Yeah, absolutely. I meet them all the time, and they can be wonderful artists and wonderful people. I do think another realistic thing, and I tell this to emerging composers and students when I talk to them, that social skills, bathing regularly, basic things like that, you know?
It doesn't matter with the internet.
That's true. Yeah. The internet, they have no idea. But some social skills, and certainly being able to write a good email, short, sweet, to the point, professional, you know, not going too far to one extreme or the other, not being too soupy and obsequious, and not being too arrogant and obnoxious. I mean, you're just put yourself out there professionally and say, you know, hey, here's what I do. I'd love to, you know, show you what I'm up to. Those are the kinds of skills I think now students, in addition to all the studying they do on music, they need to learn more and more how to best interact with people. But I think you're right that not everybody has a natural talent at it, and it can't be forced. It can be learned to some degree, and it can be improved on to some degree, but some people are going to be naturally better at it than others. But I still think that with, again, with websites, you can determine how much interaction you're actually going to have with people. I have a lot because it happens to be something I enjoy. But I think if I were less social and maybe a little less articulate, I could still get my music out there through my website, through other things, let the music speak more for itself without being, you know, the way I am. I think you can do it. I would encourage other people who are, you know, not as verbal to still do it.
If nothing else, you don't know until you try.
Right.
It strikes me that there will be people who really don't have a bigger picture of the field and who might be interested in finding out about their music. And they would be hesitant to knock on what might potentially be exactly the right performer's door, for
That's
instance,
right.
or presenter. And yet those presenters or performers are seeking people just like you
Absolutely.
In order to do their careers.
Exactly. They need the new music, too. One of the things, again, I say this to composers a lot, that they should not hesitate, I mean, beyond, you know, within reason and politely, but they should go to all the concerts they can possibly go to. And when they like something they've heard, and, you know, obviously when it's new music, when it's performers who clearly are interested in the music of living composers, go backstage, say hello, tell them how much you appreciate their work, introduce yourself. Don't necessarily shove a CD in their hands backstage. That's kind of crass, but you can definitely get to the point in the conversation where they might very much welcome your business card. And then you get theirs, or you at least know how to find them online because virtually everybody has a website, and you follow that meeting up with a nice email saying, it was such a pleasure to meet you the other night, and you know the performance was terrific, and at some point, you know, I'd love to show you the piece that I have for three kazoos and an ocarina, you know, because you play your ocarina so beautifully. I mean, whatever it is. I mean, I think performers are looking for that kind of genuine contact with people. I've never been pushed aside, not that I know of, at least. You know.
And on another level, that even operates in the grant world, I'd say, because maybe in the old days of patronage, Haydn would have to beg to get the job and the money and the livery for that week's symphony. But there are foundations, there are family foundations, there are grant-giving organizations and re-granting organizations. They have to get rid of that money. They really need to find someone who
That's
will
right.
fit the donors or the founders' will in just the right manner, who will fulfill the visions and the missions of the foundation and the organization that's passing it on. They need you just as much as you need that
money. And you've done that so beautifully with your work. You really have. You found some very good matches for what you're doing, and it's marvelous to see. You're a great example for other composers.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to wish on anyone the being an administrator for 14 years just in order to find the right project for one's own personal job. but I do see this when composers apply for programs, commissioning programs, fellowships, and residencies, and so forth. And some of them, of course, may believe that they're the ones who really by rights ought to have it that year and have no idea about the rest of the competition.
Mm-hmm.
Or indeed how the panel process works and the kinds of things that are up for grabs in that context.
But I was referring to your work as a composer.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not. Yeah.
Well, I think my own work is sort of a two-way street because, you know, I know what support's out there, I know where the glut and the constipation in the system is, and so I can take my venues elsewhere, thank you. I don't need to compete with mainstream musicians in some sense for that.
Well, because you have a flexibility, and I think flexibility is something that is such a key word also for working composers now, to be able to see different ways of approaching their careers and not be so rigid and so set in one vision. And that's something that I know you do very well.
Well, all this technology allows us to do so many things on a whole spectrum of ways. One is do the music that we were doing before and have more ways of selling it. Another is to find out what is intrinsic to that medium and be creative with that medium.
Yeah.
I mean, there are all these little 30-second animation spots. How quickly do those get around the world when there's a good one to send on to your friend? And it's not enough just to be a dots on paper person anymore. When you can perform, when you can make a video, when you can do an interactive something or other, it doesn't even need to reside in the concert hall. The venue has changed. It's on
That's
your
right.
computer monitor,
exactly.
it's in your
it's
iPod.
The iPod yeah.
So the concert hall of today is as much your car sitting in a traffic jam with your surround sound speakers or your headphones on or whatever, as it is in those venues once in a while when someone's really practiced and you're free that night to spend a lot of money to hear a one-shot deal
That's
that
right.
you may or may not like. Where does your music reside in all of that?
Oh, gosh. I tend to think of it. It resides in both places, but I tend to be putting more and more value on the recordings for just that reason, because First of all, from an archival sense, it's extremely rewarding to have good recordings from wonderful artists, and you know, to feel that your music's so well represented for a lot of people to be able to hear, because many more people are going to hear our recordings than are ever going to squeeze into a concert hall for the 1, 2, or 5, or 10 performances, you know, that a piece might get in the, you know, next couple of years or whatever. I think it's just so wonderful to have something to be able to live on much longer than that in whatever form. And I also think that that presents an interesting challenge to composers to think, very much the way pop artists always have been thinking for many years now, in terms of production. I think composers need to get more and more savvy about engineering and about production. Not that they have to move all the sliders themselves or do it digitally themselves, but they have to understand what is good production, kind of what they're competing with that is also on that person's, whoever is their audience, iPod. And learn how to present their music in its best possible light, so that if someone is listening in a recorded environment as opposed to the concert hall with the reverberation and all of that, that they're going to get a full experience, and it's going to suit the music and represent the composer and hopefully the performers if it's performed music and not electronic, as well as possible. I think these are things that more and more living composers are taking into account. Times have changed. We have different things. Many more people are going to hear our music on iPods than they're going to hear them in the concert hall. So I want to adjust to that.
Which brings up an interesting question about translocation. We're in Malibu. Our audiences aren't in Malibu, mostly.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You can be walking on the beach here and someone's clinching a deal when they should be at the office. You know, in the old days, they would have been right there, typewriter and phone, and you would have known where that deal was taking place. But now,
people are everywhere.
You don't know what they're doing while that's while they're on the phone,
mm-hmm.
which is very comfortable because you can transport the information but not the context. So in the old days, we had something called a sense of place. Writers had it, composers had it. You know, acoustic music was made usually for specific players in specific concert halls. Mm-hmm. Now that's all kind of divorced. No longer is there even the sense of a whole record album that develops from one track to the next. So
right.
It can be chopped up in any number of ways, not just by your radio DJ, but by you.
By the consumer, just downloading one iTunes track from an entire album, and that's all they're going to choose.
Which they could have done before if they just played one track of their old cassette player or 8-track or whatever. And consumers have always had some level of choice, but now there's a whole lot more to choose from, and you have a lot less to say about it. To what extent does your own music have a sense of place, and how has that changed throughout your life?
Mm. I think the place is always just me. I think it hasn't changed that much. It's grown and expanded and hopefully improved over time as I've grown and expanded over time as a person. And I think the more human we become as we get older, the more human our music is, and the more we have to say. I mean, because we're vessels, we're filling up all the time, and when we're writing a piece of music or painting a canvas or anything else, that's when we're pouring out and that expression. So sense of place in music, again, because music is so intangible. I mean, I think I can tell you, oh, I'm so deeply affected by my life here at the beach, which I clearly am, and it means so much to me, and it affects my music so much, and I can say that, but can you really hear that in my music? I doubt it. I really doubt. If someone didn't know who I was or a piece and, you know, just put on a piece of music, I sincerely doubt someone would peg that music and say, oh, it sounds like the tide pools. Oh, look, there goes a sea anemone. I don't think they're going to say that, even though I might have written it very much with that sea anemone in mind. So I think sense of place, as you say, because it has changed so much with the times, I think it changes with composers and with artists too. We are quite transportable. I suspect if I move down to Costa Rica or up to Vancouver or out to Hawaii or anywhere else, I would not sound too different, because I think art is coming from within us. So whatever is filling our hearts in general is what gets spewed.
Could we tell that you're a woman composing as opposed to a man composing?
I don't think so. It's funny because back a long time ago when I was doing a lot of commercial scoring, low-budget stuff for film and TV, very low-budget, and I had the de rigueur commercial reel, the demo reel, and I had plenty of reels that started out with an action cue for those kinds of pictures, and more than once I got the comment, especially because my name being Alex is androgynous, I would many times field calls from producers or directors calling me up, telling me how much they liked the music and that they never would have guessed that a woman wrote that, which I just thought was hilarious. I mean, it's just a silly, goofy thing. So no, I don't think music ever has a gender. And I always used to say to those same directors and producers, Claude Debussy, you know, some of the most feminine, if you want to use really silly terms about feminine and masculine, none of which I really buy into because we're all both. Some of the most feminine, stereotypically feminine sounding music has been written by men. And, you know, I think I've got plenty of pieces that we'd probably guess they're more aggressive in the way they are in some places, and you might think it was written by a guy. I don't buy into any of that gender stuff at all. Okay.